Greetings, this is Jeff Riddle from Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia, and this is another in this series of readings from and notes and commentary upon Augustine of Hippo's Harmony of the Evangelists. In this episode, we're going to be looking at Book 1, Chapters 6 and 7. And so let's begin with Book 1 and Chapter 6, which is titled, Of the Four Living Creatures in the Apocalypse, which have been taken by some in one application and by others in another, as apt figures of the four evangelists. For these reasons, it also appears to me that of the various parties who have interpreted the living creatures in the apocalypse as significant of the four evangelists, those who have taken the lion to point to Matthew, the man to Mark, the calf to Luke, and the eagle to John, have made a more reasonable application of the figures than those who have assigned the man to Matthew, the eagle to Mark, and the lion to John. For in forming their particular idea of the matter, these latter have chosen to keep in view simply the beginnings of the books and not the full design of the several evangelists in its completeness, which was the matter that should, above all, have been thoroughly examined. For surely it is with much greater propriety that the one who has brought under our notice most largely the kingly character of Christ should be taken to be represented by the lion. Thus is it also that we find the lion mentioned in conjunction with the royal tribe itself, in that passage of the Apocalypse where it is said, "The lion of the tribe of Judah hath prevailed." For in Matthew's narrative, the Magi are recorded to have come from the east to inquire after the king and to worship him whose birth was notified to them by the star. Thus too Herod, who himself also was a king, is said there to be afraid of the royal child and to put so many children to death in order to make sure that the one might be slain. Again, that Luke is intended under the figure of the calf as reference to the preeminent sacrifice made by the priest has been doubted by neither of the two sets of interpreters. For in that gospel, the narrator's account commences with Zechariah the priest. In it, mention is also made of the relationship between Mary and Elizabeth. In it, too, it is recorded that the ceremonies proper to the earliest priestly service were attended to in the case of the infant Christ, and a careful examination brings a variety of other matters under our notice in this gospel, by which it is made apparent that Luke's object was to deal with the part of the priest. In this way, it follows further that Mark, who has set himself neither to give an account of the kingly lineage, nor to expound anything distinctive of the priesthood, whether on the subject of the relationship or on that of the consecration, and who at the same time comes before us as one who handles the things which the man Christ did, appears to be indicated simply under the figure of the man among those four living creatures. But again, those three living creatures, whether lion, man, or calf, have their course upon this earth. And in like manner, those three evangelists occupy themselves chiefly with the things which Christ did in the flesh, and with the precepts which he delivered to men, who also bear the burden of the flesh for their instruction in the rightful exercise of this mortal life. Whereas John, on the other hand, soars like an eagle above the clouds of human infirmity and gazes upon the light of the unchangeable truth with those keenest and steadiest eyes of the heart. Chapter 7, titled A Statement of Augustine's Reason for Undertaking This Work on the Harmony of the Evangelists, and an example of the method in which he meets those who allege that Christ wrote nothing himself, and that his disciples made an unwarranted affirmation in proclaiming him to be God. Those sacred chariots of the Lord, however, in which he is borne throughout the earth, and brings the peoples under his easy yoke and his light burden, are assailed with calumnious charges by certain persons, who in impious vanity or in ignorant temerity think to rob of their credit as veracious historians those teachers by whose instrumentality the Christian religion has been disseminated all the world over, and through whose efforts it has yielded fruits so plentiful that unbelievers now scarcely dare so much as to mutter their slanders in private among themselves, kept in check by the faith of the Gentiles and by the devotion of all the peoples. Nevertheless, inasmuch as they still strive, by their calumnious disputations to keep some from making themselves acquainted with the faith, and thus prevent them from becoming believers, while they also endeavor, to the utmost of their power, to excite agitations among others who have already attained to belief, and thereby give them trouble. And further, as there are some brethren who, without detriment to their own faith, have a desire to ascertain what answer can be given to such questions, either for the advantage of their own knowledge, or for the purpose of refuting the vain utterances of their enemies, with the inspiration and help of the Lord our God, and would that it might prove profitable for the salvation of such men, we have undertaken in this work to demonstrate the errors or the rashness of those who deem themselves able to prefer charges, the subtlety of which is at least sufficiently observable, against those four different books of the gospel, which have been written by these four several evangelists. And in order to carry out this design to a successful conclusion, we must prove that the writers in question do not stand in any antagonism to each other. For those adversaries are in the habit of adducing this as the palmary allegation in all their vain objections, namely, that the evangelists are not in harmony with each other. But we must first discuss a matter which is apt to present a difficulty to the minds of some. I refer to the question why the Lord has written nothing himself, and why he has left us in the necessity of accepting the testimony of other persons who have prepared records of his history. For this is what these parties, the pagans more than any, allege when they lack boldness enough to impeach or blaspheme the Lord Jesus Christ himself, and when they allow him, only as a man, however, to have been possessed of the most distinguished wisdom. In making that admission, they at the same time assert that the disciples claim more for their master than he really was, so much more indeed that they even called him the Son of God and the Word of God, by whom all things were made, and affirm that he and God are one. And in the same way, they dispose of all other kindred passages in the epistles of the apostles, in the light of which we have been taught that he is to be worshipped as one God with the Father. For they are of opinion that he is certainly to be honored as the wisest of men, but they deny that he is to be worshipped as God. Wherefore, when they put the question of why he has not written in his own person, it would seem as if they were prepared to believe regarding him whatever he might have written concerning himself, but not what others may have given the world to know with respect to his life, according to the measure of their own judgment. Well, I ask them in turn, why, in the case of certain of the noblest of their own philosophers, they have accepted the statements which their disciples left in the records they have composed, while these sages themselves have given us no written accounts of their own lives. For Pythagoras, than whom Greece in those days did not possess any more illustrious personage in the sphere of that contemplative virtue, is believed to have written absolutely nothing, whether on the subject of his own personal history or on any other theme whatsoever. And as to Socrates, to whom, on the other hand, they have adjudged a position of supremacy above all others in that active virtue by which the moral life is trained, so that they do not hesitate also to aver that he was even pronounced to be the wisest of men by the testimony of their deity Apollo, it is indeed true that he handled the fables of Aesop in some few short verses, and thus made use of words and numbers of his own in the task of rendering the themes of another. But this was all. And so far was he from having the desire to write anything himself, that he declared that he had done even so much only because he was constrained by the imperial will of his demon, as Plato, the noblest of all his disciples, tells us. That was a work also in which he sought to set forth in fair form not so much his own thoughts as rather the ideas of another. What reasonable ground, therefore, have they for believing with regard to those sages all that their disciples have committed to record in respect of their history, while at the same time they refuse to credit, in the case of Christ, what his disciples have written on the subject of his life? And all the more may we thus argue when we see how they admit that all other men have been excelled by him in the matter of wisdom, although they decline to acknowledge him to be God. Is it indeed the case that those persons whom they do not hesitate to allow to have been by far his superiors have had the faculty of making disciples who can be trusted in all that concerns the narrative of their careers, and that he failed in that capacity. But if that is a most absurd statement to venture upon, then in all that belongs to the history of that person to whom they grant the honor of wisdom, they ought to believe not merely what suits their own notions, but what they read in the narratives of those who learned from this sage himself those various facts which they have left on record on the subject of his life. Here ends Augustine's Harmony of the Evangelists, Book 1 and Chapters 6 and 7, and we're going to move on to some brief notes and commentary on these two chapters. First, on Book 1, Chapter 6, titled "Of the Four Living Creatures in the Apocalypse, which have been taken by some in one application, but by others in another as apt figures of the four evangelists." Augustine discusses here the so-called tetramorph, a development in early Christian literature and art, in which the four evangelists are depicted as the four living creatures in Revelation 4, 6, and 7, drawing on Ezekiel 1, verse 10. Most early interpreters suggested that the winged man would represent Matthew, the winged lion Mark, the winged ox Luke, and the eagle to represent John. Augustine, however, reverses the first two by suggesting that Matthew should be depicted as the winged lion, given his royal emphasis on Jesus as king, and Mark should be depicted as the winged man, since he specifically describes Christ neither as a king nor as a priest. He also mentions that some associated the man to Matthew, the eagle to Mark, and others suggested that the lion would go to John, but he contends in the end that the ox is rightly given to Luke, given Luke's emphasis on Jesus as priest and the association of oxen with sacrifices, and that eagle is appropriate for John since, as Augustine puts it, he soars like an eagle in his high view of Christ. Moving on now to some notes and commentary on Book 1 in Chapter 7, which is labeled "A Statement of Augustine's Reason for Undertaking This Work on the Harmony of the Evangelists and an Example of the Method in which he meets those who allege that Christ wrote nothing himself and that his disciples made an unwarranted affirmation proclaiming him to be God." Augustine begins this chapter by describing the Gospels as chariots in which Christ is born throughout the earth and brings the peoples under his easy yoke and his light burden. This image in Augustine will later be picked up on by John Calvin when he writes his commentary on the first three Gospels, his Harmony of the Evangelists. Augustine also notes the calumnious attacks on the Gospel by those who want to keep men from the faith. Thus he sets out in particular to show that the Gospels, quote, do not stand in any antagonism to each other, end quote. In other words, he wants to harmonize the Gospels for those who attack them for inconsistencies among the different accounts. He also addresses the criticism raised by some that Jesus himself wrote nothing, but that we learn of his life and teaching only through the writings of his disciples. And there are some who suggested that the disciples of Jesus exaggerated their master. Such men say that Jesus was the wisest of men, but they deny that he is to be worshipped as God. Augustine responds by pointing out that some of the most admired pagan philosophers left behind no writings, like Pythagoras and Socrates, but they were written about by their disciples. If they accept the records of the philosophers, then why not accept the gospel accounts of Jesus? In conclusion, in this discussion, we see Augustine again talking about both a matter of literature and art, the tetramorph, and a matter of apologetics. With respect to the tetramorph, depicting the gospel writers according to the four living creatures of Revelation and Ezekiel, Augustine uses this as an opportunity to discuss what makes each gospel distinctive. With respect to apologetics, he defends the harmony of the four gospels and their historical reliability, even though Jesus did not write anything and none of his writings are in the gospels. Augustine contends that This should be accepted just as the pagans accept the writings, of the reports of Socrates or the reports of Pythagoras written by his disciples. And so he's defending here the authenticity, the historicity, the harmony of the four Gospels. Well, this brings this episode to a conclusion. I hope that this has been helpful and edifying for those who are listening, and I'll look forward to speaking to you in the next issue in this series. Till then, take care and God bless.